My name is Mark Cooper. I am Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America, which will actually put out a document next week when the irregulators file their reply comments. I am also an irregulator and proud to be one. And so it's fallen to me to try and set the context for this in terms of that consumers can understand, since that's where I have spent my entire career in the consumer movement. And there's a couple, three ways I can sort of locate it. One is, look, this case was sort of a little engine that might. People would look at it and they say, wait. And now, in the last few weeks, it's become, I think, a big locomotive that can really help to pull a bunch of issues to the finish line. One case is the FCC lost a case in which the court said they did bad math. And bad math doesn't cut it. In fact, in this case, it's not only bad math, they just don't do math. They simply stopped doing the math a long time ago, and they hope they can get away with it. They try to claim that they've sort of thought about that, but that's what the court case is about. The second case is net neutrality, and I'll deal with that at the end. So the non-math is the important point. And there's a simple way to describe that. 20 years ago, the FCC looked at the cost of the telephone network and said, look, it's mostly local revenues, and therefore it's mostly local costs. And they set up a rule, depending on how where you do the math, 65% of the revenues were local, intrastate. Bruce will tell you that's utility Title II revenues. And 65%, therefore they said, let's put 65% of the costs over there. At the moment, you know, that looked reasonable. The problem was that in the last 20 years, as everybody on this call knows, the structure of the communications industry has changed dramatically. And within 2 years, the AT&T, which at that point was a standalone long-distance company, and they had decided they were going to lead as a potential competitor and long-distance company, they start to complain about that stupid allocation, the frozen allocation, the frozen separation factor or frozen spiff. Don't try and remember those words. Doesn't make any sense, and they complained about it, and over the years, the FCC has held proceedings to say, well, we froze it back then, we're going to leave it. Even though the revenues were moving in one direction and the costs were moving in another direction. By 2007, it got really messy, so they just stopped publishing the data. And they stopped collecting the data, right? They stopped doing the math. We come to today, and that 65 revenue, 65 costs is now 20% revenue and 60% cost. That is, there's been this tremendous migration of revenue elsewhere. But the FCC keeps saying, put 65% of the cost or 60% of the cost over there on the locals. And that means, and Bruce will tell you, in New York, if you look at the cost of the plant, of putting physical infrastructure in, they keep charging it off to local service, even though that's disappearing. And they're spending all of their effort on broadband and wireless. The same thing is true with corporate operations, where they're still dumping all these costs onto the local guys and insisting that they're not spending any money on the wireless broadband and more competitive services. Well, this is either the dumbest management on the planet, spending all its money on a dying service, or it's just the clever accounting rules that the FCC has sanctioned by freezing this allocation. And in fact, if you look at the state, and New York is one state that said, you guys got to keep doing the books for us. We want to see your local books. We want to see what you're doing with the costs. Very few states did. But God bless New York. They kept saying, I want to see the costs. And it's quite clear that the competitive services, wireless and broadband, have been the recipients of massive cross subsidies. That is, they're not paying their costs. The costs are being collected from local ratepayers, and Bruce will tell you his phone bill has gone up by almost double, at least 1.5 times. So every time they dump the money cost onto the local network, they say, we're losing money on local service, raise the rates. But they weren't actually losing money on local service. They were allocating all the costs from the other service to local to make it look like they were losing money. Now, why would they do that? Collect their revenues from the captives, which is a classic. The textbooks will tell you that's what monopolists do. They were doing that because it let them have a lot of free cash floating around so that they could subsidize their competitive businesses. So they didn't charge their wireless business for the cell towers or the use of the network or the corporate executive time. They didn't charge them for that. But when someone tried to buy a competing wireless service from them, they charge them full price. That's called a price squeeze, and it kills competition. So that's the second harm of what they did. One, they increased local rates. Two, they cross-subsidized competitive, which limited my choice as a consumer and killed competition. And, of course, the third thing they did is they had massive excess profits because in the gap between the federal and the state jurisdictions, the competitive services had huge high rates of profit. I, in my analysis, use earnings before interest, dividends, and depreciation and taxes. So that's where we are. We've gone through 20 years of a fixed factor that no longer bears any relationship to reality and which the FCC has refused to do the math on. And we've gone to the court and convinced the court that this is an important issue. The FCC wants to say, oh, it doesn't matter for this reason, that reason. We got a great lawyer who's explained why it does matter, and we've got some economics that explain. And so we're in court. And what will happen if we win? Well, if we win and the FCC is forced to revisit this silliness, we will set off a scrum, and I said this in my testimony. There'll be a scrum at the local level to ask this question. Wait a minute. We paid all this money, and they should have collected it from those people, and they collect it for us, and they raise their rates. There'll be a scrum over money. I can't tell you exactly how that scrum will come out, but it's impossible for the consumer not to be better off because we will get better cost allocation. That's what this case is about. Hopefully that's English. The interesting thing is, so if you hear that discussion, if there's a remand at the federal level, it will reinvigorate the states to take a look at it, or at least we'll be able to mobilize people at the state level and say, wait a minute, they told us they would build this, they collected a bunch of money from us, they raised their rates, and we didn't get what we paid for, and we're paying too much for what we got. That's an interesting proceeding to have. Let me do the network neutrality case to tie it up on the back end here. If you look at the network neutrality case, as someone put it to me yesterday, everyone lost something they really wanted. They won some things they wanted, and the way they won them has everybody scratching their heads, and there's a lot of trepidation. So let me walk through the winners and losers. And given where we are in this case, one of the big losers is the FCC. Why? Because the court, as I understand it, trashed their analysis. That is, just like the last court said, you can't get away with bad math, this court said, this analysis is not very good. But unfortunately, you have this broad discretion, agency discretion, known as Chevron deference for the aficionados. It's agency expertise and flexibility. So you got this flexibility, we're going to have to let you go. The second thing the FCC tried to do is that what I call the administrative appeal of the Communications Act of 34. They wanted to step back from regulating this stuff, and so they said, well, look, we're not going to do this. You got other agencies that can take care of it. Consumers can complain and let them go elsewhere. So they really wanted to abandon their responsibility. But they did that to such an extreme that the court said, if you're going to not occupy the field with regulation, then you can't preempt the states from entering that space. We're going to have a big fight about that. We've been fighting about the Commerce Clause since the ink dried on the Constitution. So be it. But this one clearly reinvigorated the question of local authority to do stuff. And if you've been following it, there's been a big fight about privacy and efficiency and a variety of things between the feds and states. The FCC lost those two things: quality of analysis and administrative repeal of the 34 Act. The companies really wanted preemption, and they lost it, even though there was Chevron deference, and there's going to be a fight about that. The public interest clearly lost Title II. They wanted Title II. But the basis of that loss was very broad Chevron deference to an order that did not have very good analysis behind it. So if you're sitting there and you're saying, wait a minute, imagine what I could get with good analysis, which is what some of us think we had under Title II. So broad deference with good analysis means to me that, hey, you know what? We can probably get this stuff back in the blink of an eye if there's a change in administration. So what we now have here is we set the stage for local fights. If we win this case, we set the stage for local fights. The D.C. Circuit has already set the stage for local fight over network neutrality. What this case brings to the table, network neutrality is really important. People who know me, I've been fighting for it since 1998. It is a concept. It is a value. What this court case brings to the table is money. There are $50 billion in the past that we're going to fight about. But more importantly, there's the future $50 or $100 billion. Because now they want to deploy 5G, and I have my New York Times here, and the bottom advertisement on the front page, very expensive, says, Verizon, 5G built right, but build wrong. If we prove that they build wrong, there's going to be a hiccup, a pause, maybe even a fainting spell over 5G. That's why we need to do this right now, because we're about to spend a boatload of money under a set of rules that bear no relationship to reality and result in consumer and economic harm. How's that? Maybe 5 minutes.
No.
I will pass this on to Bruce. That's the future. But in order to understand the future, you really need to also understand the past. And that is where Bruce is an expert.
So it's 1984. There's a company called Ma Bell, also known as AT&T. And AT&T owns all of the state utilities in the United States, or at least 80%. There's another company called GTE that owns pretty much the rest of them, and there's some other independents. But essentially, one company owned all the wires. And these wires were basically required by the Telecom Act of 1934 that said everybody in the United States is entitled to a phone service, and that phone service will be delivered over a copper wire. And it will go to everybody's home and everybody's office, and everybody's entitled to it. And this is known as carrier of last resort. No matter where you are, no matter what you are, the state utility, you have to be served. This law in 1984, they decided to break up AT&T because the other services, such as being able to use other companies to use local service or other companies offering long distance, which was the big pie. Long distance is a call between states. The long-distance market was priced at a point where it was 50 cents a minute, where local service was basically $8. And so there were some subsidies between the two, but MCI, a scrappy little company, wanted to go out with a lot of lawyers, wanted to go out and get into the long-distance business, so they broke up AT&T in 1984. And so in 1984, there were 7 baby bells created around the United States. Now, the baby bells were fat babies because they were like, there was one called 9X, which was from Maine to New York. There was Bell Atlantic from New Jersey down to Virginia. And there was in California, there was Pacific Telesis, which was California and Nevada. And there's these other companies. So essentially, they divided the world into 7 big land companies regional Bell operating companies, and they controlled various state utilities. So the state utility in California would be Pacific Bell, and in New York it was New York Telephone, and then 9X New York. Now, as the future was coming, 1991, and Al Gore suggests that we should take those copper wires, and which are basically some of them been put in since the 1920s. And 1930s and 1940s. In fact, by 1970, pretty much all of America was wired with a copper wire. And the plan was to replace that wire with a fiber optic wire that would go to people's homes and would basically compete with cable, which was the big other service that was starting to get noise. Now, in the 1990s, so Al Gore says we should have the information superhighway, and we should have it government-funded. And then the phone companies said, no, we, the phone companies, will definitely rewire our states if you just give us the right to go out and do this and what they call price caps, which is we need a lot more money, so we're going to charge consumers, but we'll keep the price flat, and we will use the extra money to build out these networks than pay for construction. So in New Jersey, for example, 100% of the state of New Jersey, which was 95% of the state of New Jersey, which was now Verizon New Jersey, but was called New Jersey Bell, was supposed to have 45 megabit speeds starting in both directions starting in 1996 and have the state completed by the year 2010. In California, 5.5 million households were supposed to be upgraded to fiber optics by the year 2000, and Pac Bell said they were spending $16 billion to do this. Every state had some plan that was basically changed the laws that gave them what they call price caps so they can go out and rewire that state and replace it. But the laws were changed, so now fiber optics was the new standard in many of the states. This part has been slowly forgotten over time. So by the year 2000, which was supposed to have half of America almost relatively completed, they had done nothing. And in every state, basically, they had collected billions per state and didn't do anything. So this first phase, in 2004, I wrote a book called The 200 Billion Broadband Scandal, which said, by the year 2004, none of the companies had done any of the fiber optic wiring, except some states, like Ohio and Wisconsin, and they had rolled out cable services over a fiber optic wire. Now, by 1996, the situation changes. So let me just go back. So we have 93, they announced all the fiber optic wires. In 96, they said these wires should be open to all competitors. And this was done by – and then AT&T, which had become a long-distance company, and MCI, which has become a long-distance company, wanted in on the local networks. And so they said, listen, you have to open up these networks so that we can offer both local and long-distance service to customers. And so in 1996, the Telecommunications Act passed. It also allowed small independent Internet service providers to offer services to the United States. By the year 2000, there were 9,335 independent ISPs that were offering Internet service to the majority of the United States. And so what you had was the Telecommunications Act of 1996 said, okay, we're opening all these wires. Any company can use them for all these different services. And so that was trend number one. Trend number two, the Internet hit, and that was because of the small Internet service providers. And so suddenly everybody wanted to go online, and they were very excited about using dial-up, which was to use the regular phone line for broadband because the broadband networks weren't built. And the third part of this was the companies decided, well, you know, we, in order to get to compete with these other new companies, we have to merge. So what happened was SBC, Southwestern Bell, which had Texas and some other states, and Oklahoma, it basically started buying the other Bells. It bought Pac Bell, which is in California. It bought an independent known as SNET, which was Connecticut. And so the mergers of these companies should never have happened because they didn't want to compete. They just wanted to merge. By the end of 2007, they had all merged into three basic companies, which was AT&T had now 21 states it controlled, Verizon on the East Coast, and essentially had a thing called GTE, which is spread around the country, which they sold off, most of those products. And there was US West, which turned into Quest, which turned into CenturyLink, which was the western states, such as Washington and the Dakotas. However, so we have these companies that the third trend was they decided to merge. By 2000, we have a takeover of the FCC by the Republican Party, and they decide, well, they convince the FCC that we really we're losing money on these networks now. You know, this competition is really harming us. We've merged, and if you get rid of all the competitors, we will be glad to go out and offer fiber optic broadband, of which people forgot that there was already a plan to offer fiber optic broadband a decade ago. And so this is phase two. They said, we will roll out Fios and we will roll out UVerse if we can open up the networks to get rid of all the competitors. And so in 2005 and 2006, 7,000 Internet service providers went out of business, small ones. And the companies that were supposed to, the AT&T said, we're going to offer UVerse. Now, they consolidated a little more. They took over the long-distance companies. And so AT&T bought, so SBC and Southwestern Bell, who had merged with all the other ones, took over AT&T and took its name. So you suddenly had, and Verizon took over MCI, and so what you basically had was a scene where they got rid of all the competitors, the only thing left was going to be cable, and the only time, and so what you had was all of these companies now suddenly saying, we're going to roll out fiber again. Verizon goes and said, we're going to roll out Fios, and AT&T said, we're going to roll out U-verse, and AT&T didn't tell anybody that U-verse was going to be a copper to the home service using the old copper wires, and that basically they would just reclassify it as a no longer part of the state utility because it's now broadband and known as an IP service. And Verizon was supposed to replace all the wires with Fios in different states under cable franchises this time. And so by the time they were, Verizon left, did about 40% of their territories. AT&T basically never rolled out. They rolled out U-verse, but except by the year 2017, AT&T has 3 million total fiber optic wires out of 76 million locations it covers. Verizon has about 40% of their states covered, and there's giant holes and gaps, and they stopped. Now, in 2007, the iPhone hits, and suddenly, oh, my God, we should be a wireless company. So what we found was in by 2010, Verizon had stopped, AT&T had stopped, and they decided to take their budgets and start moving them in from the state utility and start moving them into the wireless company, of which in 2010, Verizon did a wholesale move of the networks, so they weren't even working on the wires anymore, and they moved all the CWA and IBEW union staff to do the wireless networks. We know this from interviews with those guys. Now, all of these were cross-subsidized. All these lines of business, we found out later, that as Mark said, all the costs had suddenly been manipulated, which we did not know about. It took us years and years to figure this out. And the bottom line was, at the end of the day, they were able to take the budgets that were supposed to go for the state utility and move it to all the other lines of business, and basically through the FCC's rules, and nobody caught them. And nobody ever saw this because they started erasing all the accounting, and they started erasing all the documentation. So in 2007, the FCC stopped publishing the data. And the only reason why we could take this case is because Verizon was required in the state of New York to publish full annual reports every year. Now, just so you know, in 2010, we started finding all the stuff out, but we didn't know what it meant. 2011, 12, 13, and 14, we started writing reports. 2015, we sort of put together the regulators because we now had guys who understood the accounting and how they tied back to the FCC's rules, which we did not know. And in 2015, we filed a complaint with for an investigation. And in 2018, there was a settlement in New York for and they were required to do 32,000 lines of fiber in unserved areas in 2018, and also maintain the copper wires, which they stopped maintaining since the 90s. So we now have a totally deteriorating plant throughout the United States. The wireless services are being built out of the local phone state utility budgets. And the big money, the really big money, is the corporate operations expense. In New York, because of the FCC rules, local service, one category, which had 22% of the revenues, paid $1.8 billion in corporate operations expense, which was set by the FCC's rules in the year 2000, and that's never been audited, and that corporate operations expenses, the executive pay, the lawyers that were used to get rid of net neutrality, the golf tournaments, it's never been audited, and it is a giant pot of money. So our take on the case is, first, we're exposing all this stuff, because nobody's ever seen this before, not even us. And so we can't really blame anybody for not knowing all these stories because essentially we didn't really know them for the last couple of years. And now the goal is all this money, if we started to reallocate it back to where it belongs, there would be billions of dollars per state to upgrade the state. That's what we believe. Nobody's gone after the money, and each state, by the way, is different. Because of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, they've been erasing and dismantling the state utilities. Many of them don't collect the information anymore, like California. They don't look at the books. And so when suddenly there's a wake-up call, which is the stuff that we have in New York, the data, we believe that the rest of the states could wake up and tie it to net neutrality and tie it to all of the other things like stopping the 5G deployments, because essentially 5G is not profitable when you when it has to pay for the wires that are being put in. Now, we're talking about an incredible amount of money. As Mark said, it's $50 to $60 billion annually that we think is out there that we can go after. So this case was sort of in the works for at least 5 years. We filed at the FCC 18 separate documents and filings since 2015 in this one proceeding. And I have to say I'm incredibly proud to be an irregular. So I turn it over to Chuck, who's going to talk about digital divide and municipalities.
Chuck? Yeah. Thanks, Mark, and thanks, Bruce. I have a very different take on this because of my background in government, regional planning, and those kind of fun things. Mark really nailed all the consumer issues. Bruce has lived the history, as a lot of us have. But I look at all of this in a couple of different ways, particularly because everything ends up getting based in law and how law is interpreted. On a municipal level, all municipalities have a fiduciary responsibility to manage the public rights of way for the public interest. Needless to say, municipalities never really ended up being able to totally control the telephone companies as they built out their networks. It was a very different story for the cable industry because cable was originally nothing other than ancillary to broadcasting, and all it was a way of delivering a clean signal into people's homes who couldn't receive over-the-air broadcasting. And so the municipalities were able to go ahead and claim the ability to manage their rights of way by granting franchises. Those franchises laid out all kinds of responsibilities on the part of the cable companies, including build-out requirements. There could not be any redlining. We know that that is a big issue as the phone companies have rolled out their broadband. There are issues of redlining with cable companies. They're not clean on this, but they're not as bad as the phone companies as they've rolled out the newer technologies, whether it was leaving the copper or whether it was going ahead and upgrading to fiber. Then there's the other legal issues, and that has more to do with the federal laws and the regulations that the FCC created and the series of categories, the Title I, Title II, Title VI, those different categories. And as we know, law is usually about how do we manipulate the law for the benefit of our clients? And if we really look at the various titles, we can see how the corporate interest that behind the creation of these definitions, and particularly once you get to the 96 Telecom Act, that's where Title I comes in, and that became then the bugaboo. What is an IP service? But in the reality, all of this, all these wires and all the services that are delivered over these wires are really, it's using the same ground, it's using the same wires. They just go ahead and play regulatory games in order to deliver their services and make way more money than they should be off of these services. That's kind of my take on all of this. Way back in 96 when I was actively involved with NATOA, the National Telecommunications Office is an advisor to basically all the cable administrators around the countries for municipalities and counties. Their national association, I served on their public policy committee, and I wrote a paper that basically said that we should go ahead and declare all the different titles irrelevant, come up with a new title that says anybody who uses the public rights of way in order to deliver communication services should pay the same fees for those services, so that the municipalities can go ahead and do their fiduciary responsibility for the public interest. That's kind of my take on all of this.
I guess I'm. Let me take this over for a second, and I guess then we'll throw it open to questions. But so the last you just heard, Chuck's comments, bring it back to the local level. Bruce, at great length, talked about the state public utility commissions, which made commitments, which got commitments, and the commitments were never lived up to. A lot of it was facilitated by the FCC. And obviously, you've heard my spiel on the pocketbook impact. I mean, this is a very big line item in the average household budget. And you can say, well, if you pay for it and it's wireless, or you pay for it and your landline, does it matter? Well, of course, they're different people. And second of all, there's also a lot of price squeeze and excess profit between the two. So what happens here with this case and the other two cases I just mentioned is that we are on the verge of having a great deal of activity down at the state and local level. I personally appeared before many cable utility franchises in 2000, and they were all ready to ask for network neutrality, and of course the feds kind of squashed them. Well, that's on the table again. Network neutrality is on the table, certainly at the local level. And as I say, the one thing that's been missing, if you think about those issues, is a big pocketbook issue. Well, here it is. And that's why we think this is the moment to that this little case that might is now a big case that really could have a big impact.
No.
So with that, I guess let's throw it open to questions if folks have.
Okay, I have a question then. I mean, there's a lot of reverse Robin Hood behavior going here, where we're robbing from the poor to give to the rich, the wireless companies in this case. And the case, however, is a fairly narrow thing about the 6-year extension of a freeze. If Scott can just address right now, if we argue and win the case, what are the outcomes that are good for us? And then if we argue and lose the case, how do we make lemonade out of those lemons?
All right. Let me try to take that in order. If we argue and win, if we win, if the court does in fact remand and potentially even vacate, here's what happens. And being a lawyer, you probably understand that the relief portion of what the court would do has a big impact. In administrative law, the court can simply remand for further processing and a better explanation while still allowing the rule to stay in effect, or it can vacate the rule and remand. Now, let me take the latter option second. If they vacate the rule, then the separations freeze goes away. And all these carriers have to redo their separation studies and recalculate their rates, which means many of the rates would change at the interstate jurisdiction. But more importantly, it would allow for a freewheeling inquiry by the states for intrastate rates. The real target here, as has been mentioned earlier, is at the state level. The states have up until now been forced to rely on the FCC accounting rules. Despite all this discussion of forbearance, they still look at rates using separated costs, and base their conclusions on comparing prices to what they would be under a traditional approach using separations. So if the rule is vacated, the states would be able to go forward, get new intrastate cost results. That would mean intrastate costs would go down, and therefore rates would go down by a lot, a whole lot, billions.
And does that affect price cap carriers equally to the cost-based
yes.
carriers?
Yes. If you're talking about at the intrastate jurisdiction, yes. It probably would not affect price cap carriers for interstate rates. But keep in mind that the interstate rates that exist for price cap carriers, it's not basic local. Okay? It's things like switched access charges that interexchange carriers pay, fixed lines that the wireless carriers and the internet service providers get. Those rates likely would not change. If anything, there would be pressure for them to go up, but I doubt that they would. The real impact here is going to be at the state level. The problem we have is that state rates are just hugely out of whack. They're just way too high and have been for years. And if we prevail, especially if there is a vacator, then the states would be able to go forward almost immediately and begin to reduce intrastate rates.
Okay, now
just like,
as
a result of the D.C. Circuit decision on Monday, the states are now free to begin instituting intrastate net neutrality regimes.
And we in California already have one, which is good.
Yes.
But the second question is, now what if we lose? And how do we make lemonade out of those lemons?
Well, I actually have been trying to build into the case a win-by-losing strategy. Okay?
All right.
One of the reasons I spent so much time arguing that the states are bound by Part 36, even though there has been forbearance.
Which is the rules at play. Yeah.
Right. Is that the FCC's only response is, no, they're not. And so the court could deliver us a loss in our main arguments by saying, no, you're just wrong. The states aren't bound by these separations rules. They can do whatever they want. Well, guess what happened? The states are now free to devise their own separations amounts, right? And they can reset rates, just like if we win.
Okay, so for the uninitiated, just so people, you're very familiar with Part 36, Harry may not be, but there's a four-step separations thing or process going on here where you kind of put them into certain buckets, either 80 or 120 categories. That's the first step. Then you have to split it between regulated and unregulated. Then you eventually get to splitting among intrastate and interstate. When you say Part 36, you're talking about that last part, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I did that for Harry's
case,
benefit.
Yeah, this case does not directly involve, I mean, it's all kind of underlying it, but it does, our legal challenge does not directly involve the use of what you're talking to here, which is the Uniform System of Account, Part 32. Where you define the buckets and split between regulated and unregulated, which also, by the way, involves Part 64. I know I'm speaking Greek here. But no, you're right. That's the first step. But this case does not involve that first step.
I understand. But I just want everybody to understand that, you know, this is kind of the end of the separations process.
This is Mark Cooper. Let me say this very simply, and I think Scott explains it as a lawyer, and I think the brief is just wonderful.
It's great.
So if we win and the rule is vacated, all hell breaks loose. That's the only way to describe it, because now states that have not been looking at this are going to be be told that they should be looking at it. And I think there's going to be a lot of people at the local level who have local bills that say, you better look at it. So if it's vacated, all hell breaks loose. If it's remanded, and here I might disagree a little bit with Scott, if it's only remanded, half of hell breaks loose. Because if it's remanded for the FCC to look at the rules and think again, the question is going to be, can they pretend as if the freeze made sense? And the states are going to have an incentive because for 20 years now, the revenue has been scooting to the interstate jurisdiction, flying up there as quick as, I mean, you've never seen anything like it in the 100 years of telephone, but all the costs have been stuck down here at the intrastate level. So even if there's a remand, a lot of people are going to say, wait a minute, the future rules have to reflect the current reality. So if they were to say, okay, let's do reality. 20 years ago, we said reality was 65 or 75, 25. Today, reality is the exact opposite. Well, if they did that, there's a massive recovery of costs in the interstate jurisdiction going forward, and a reduction in recovery of costs in the intrastate jurisdiction. The biggest, quote, victim of that need to rethink costs is going to be 5G, because that's where they want to spend CapEx.
Yep.
And they've been mucking around with CapEx for the last 20 years.
I agree with that on 5G. I agree with that on 5G. Even in the instance of a remand without vacator, it's going to put considerable pressure on the financial underpinnings of the way that they're funding 5G.
And that's why your case needs to be argued before the D.C. Court of Appeals, and that is my main pitch.
Absolutely, and I said in my affidavit, we're about to do more harm in the next decade than we did in the past two. I know Bruce, that upsets Bruce, because he and I fought about that. But we're at
I agree with you. We're in the wrong direction completely, yeah.
This is an extremely important moment to fix this misallocation, because they're about to make a huge commitment on the basis of it, and that's going to just hurt everybody.
Right.